You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. On this episode, I welcome someone who's a big part of my ongoing adventures into the worlds of the weird and the paranormal, Kev Eustace. Kev is, of course, the host of two phenomenal podcasts, We Need to Talk About Ghosts and Dark Paranormal. As the new season of Dark Paranormal drops across the world, Kev joins me to talk ghosts, metaphysics, poltergeists, psychics, and the paranormal. There are not many parts of the paranormal we don't touch in this week's conversation. A big thank you to Kevin for his time and conversation. As always though, before we get there, you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. A big thank you to everyone who continues to support Mysteries and Monsters with their Patreon contributions. It means a great deal, and I thank each and every one of you. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. And don't forget, you can get your Mysteries and Monsters merchandise from visiting mysteriesandmonsters.com, along with news and episodes as well. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So, let us peel back the layers of the world of the supernatural in the company of the marvellous Kev Eustace. Tonight, I am delighted to be joined by a man whose body of work I admire a great deal. With a sharp turn of wit and a passion for the paranormal, Kevin Eustace hosts two of my favourite shows, We Need to Talk About Ghosts and Dark Paranormal, covering a whole range of encounters. From the fun to the frightening, this paranormal prince of the pool has it covered. Kevin, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Paul. That's very kind of you. What was that? I like that. The paranormal prince of the pool.
Yes.
Oh, I love alliteration, and that is perfect. I specifically like alliteration with peas and for some reason.
Yeah. Well, I was going to try and remember how my auntie taught me to say the pool. I was going to say peel. But I thought I'd probably insult you, Kev, because it's been a long time since I was wandering the streets of Birkenhead.
Oh, no. Do as many Scouse accents as you like. There was a girl I met in Scotland, and she thought it was hysterical that she pronounced the whirl, the whale, like, as in whale. She's like, do you go with the whale? It's like, that's the whale. It's on a genuinely serious note. It's an absolute pleasure to be on your show. It's rare. I mean, we've spoken on the Ghost Story Guys podcast mm-hmm. that you co-host.
Yeah.
But there's a certain level of only a certain small amount of people who I think Christ on a bike. They know their business inside and out. And you're certainly, like, you know, you're within that lexicon most definitely, like, so. It's an honour to be on your show, mate. And as I said to you when we discussed me coming on, it's largely going to be me, I imagine, asking you stuff and asking for clarification on stuff, so.
Oh, I'll try my best not to rip up any dreams or paranormal loves that you have, Kev.
Please do, that's the thing, yeah.
So, as I said in the introduction, mate, you're the host of two phenomenal shows that you've been regularly releasing for a couple of years now. What brought you to the paranormal, Kev? Because people have all kinds. I love people's origin stories when it comes to how they've got to this point of being interested in specific aspects of the whole Fortean world.
Yeah.
So we're of a very similar vintage. Kev, are you like me that you were corrupted by being bought a copy of the Usborne Book of Ghosts as a child and Arthur C. Clarke, or was it family members that corrupted you, or did you just hear a spooky story as a child and that's where your love came from?
It was a mix of all three of those things, but most definitely the Usborne book. In fact, my partner Becca got me the remake.
Yes.
You know, they reprinted it recently, so she got me that. But that book, I constantly had out as a child from the library. I mean, my interest in the paranormal is from as early as I can remember. It's from my mum. She died when I was 16, but prior to that, I mean, obviously not since then because she's dead. Mm. But prior to that, she was very, you know, my dad's not into the paranormal at all, but my mum was.
Mm.
And my dad and my other family members, I've got one brother, one sister, they're into football, they're all Blues, or Evertonians, if you will.
Yes.
And I'm not really into sport, if I'm being honest. I like, you know, I like boxing, I like wrestling, and that's about it. Mm. And my mum, just out of spite, would say she's a Liverpoolian. Like, so I would also say I'm a Liverpoolian, although I'm not arsed. but what I was arsed in was me and her would sit down, even when I was like 7 or 8, and I'd show a deep interest in the paranormal, and she'd tell me tales that she's experienced. And she was a huge believer, and she had a load of experiences herself that that she couldn't explain. And she'd tell me these wonderful stories of, infamously, within our family anyway, she got smacked on the arse once by a ghost as she was washing her hair, bent over the sink, and went to kick off at me dad, and he was in the back garden mowing the lawn. And so she was a deep believer. And so that mixed with, you know, I started a ghost club in school when I was age like 6.
Yeah.
And it had fluctuating members, but never more than 2, because like after a week, somebody, like the person who joined me, would be like, "This is a bit crap," and I'd be like, "It's not, it's great." Yeah, it's a combination of things, really. But you know, I've always been interested in the unknown, and I knew that Osborne book you're talking about. When I told Becca it was being reprinted, I said, "I know it inside and out now." Before you've even bought me that copy,
yeah,
I could probably write it out page for page. So yeah, so realistically, it's nothing that I've got into at a later age. You know, so especially I find with ufology, a lot of people can fall into it in like the 20s or whichever, you know, and gain interest in later on. But paranormalness, specifically ghosts, I think I think it hits you before age 10 if you're going to be into it.
Mm. I think, as you say there, that's a good point. It seems to be the thing that gets most people into the world of the weird is ghosts as young kids, as you say, because I think things like cryptids, we're probably a little bit spoilt in the UK, Kev, because we've got Nessie. So,
well, yeah,
most of us would have heard of that, and anybody who's grown up in North America, they've obviously got tales of Sasquatch and Bigfoot to get them into it. But ufology seems to be one of those that does tend to be something that you kind of come to last. It certainly was for me. But it's the one that I went into, got really into, and left the longest, I think, because I just got fed up of the same things in the 90s. So it take me probably till the last 5 years to kind of really start looking at everything that's happened over there. Obviously I was aware of certain cases that had happened that had gone on, you know, what was going on at the O'Hare airport in Chicago with that strange flying disc over it that everybody tried to claim was a weather formation, so you'd hear stories like that. And obviously listening to other paranormal podcasts before this launched, I'd obviously kept my finger on the pulse of things that were going on. But yeah, I think ghosts are the things that get you early, and everything else tends to follow.
You do, and it's an interesting point that you make there. It you know, I've yet to meet a person who believes in ghosts and rules out UFOs. Do you know what I mean? So there is a tale of a comet, if you like, in terms of the belief system. But interestingly, getting back to the Osborne books, as you well know, they also done UFOs and was it called Monsters?
It is.
Yeah, and it went in that order for me. It was like it's the UFO one. I think it had on the front, was it the Hopkinsville Goblins?
Yeah.
On the front. And and then it was like cryptids, which, whereas getting back to, you know, without blowing smoke up your backside, it's your level of knowledge within all of these areas is peak. It's like, you know, if I say to someone, Lonnie Zamora, for example.
Socorro.
Yeah, exactly. Not many people are going to know the shape of the thing, the craft that landed, or the symbol on the side, or anything. Yeah. They're going to say, "Who's that? Is he like a banjo player or something?" But So it's interesting, but whereas this is the thing about levels. It's like, and this is the other thing that I would say as well. I mean, on my own personal defense level, if you like, from when the two podcasts that I do, We Need to Talk About Ghosts and The Dark Paranormal. We Need to Talk About Ghosts. Me turned up to 12, if you like, and I'm a bit of a jokey arsehole in normal life, and can be annoying, and it's very Marmite. People can listen and go, can't stand them, and I get it.
Yeah.
And I've got fans of The Dark Paranormal, which is much more straight-laced, and it's done in a dramatic red fashion, and they can't stand We Need to Talk About Ghosts, and I get it. And, you know, it's chalk and cheese. But the one thing that when doing We Need to Talk About Ghosts, I've always thought, you know what? I'm not really putting across... I never feel like I'm putting across the actual knowledge that I've got in the topic, do you know what I mean? Or the things that I've read, or without research is the wrong word, really, because it's not like I'm studying for a paper. But, like, you know, I'm looking right now at a bookcase next to me, and it's filled, there's about 80 books in there, with all ranging from Colin Wilson through to, like, random local ghost stories.
Yeah.
And it's theories on the topic and things like this, and... Obviously, when you do We Need to Talk About Ghosts, and you get me going, hey, bananas, and it kind of, people must think, oh, he's just an idiot who just likes ghosts. So it's nice to have the balance of the two shows, because it gets to be, with The Dark Paranormal, especially with, and this isn't a plug, but within the Patreon part of it, I do shorter stories, so when someone sends in a story, for those who don't know, The Dark Paranormal, someone sends in a story, and if it's long enough to make a 30-minute episode, I'll dramatize it up, I'll add sound effects, and it'll be a nice... The idea is, genuinely, me as Kevin Eustace, I do believe the paranormal should be something we should be afraid of, or have a healthy fear of. And therefore, because there's a lot of paranormal shows around where I do it with We Need to Talk About Ghosts. They'll read stories out where it's like, oh, my pet dog died, and you know what, a week later I felt it brushing past my leg. And I'm like, yeah, that's all well and good, but you know what, no one's going to make a film out of that, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
No one's going to sit there and hide behind the couch because Benji's come back. So The Dark Paranormal, if they send in stories like that, I don't read them out. I want someone who's been dragged down the stairs, do you know what I mean? And that I want people to be scared. But a lot of the time, like 9 out of 10 emails that I'll be received each day now is they don't make up half an hour. So I keep them for the Patreon episodes, and that allows me to bring forth a bit more of the knowledge that I've got. You know, when I'm talking in between stories.
Yeah.
So, for example, on the last one, I was talking about tulpas, and I was talking about the Colin experiments and things like this. And, you know, and it's just a nice, it's good for me to kind of prove me worth, if you like. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? That makes sense?
Yeah, of course it does. I think it's one of those things, because for me, I'm sort of humbled when anybody invites me to join them on their particular show, Kev. And because I just talk as though, for me, it's like water off a duck's back. You know, yeah. I never go out with an intention of saying, look at me, aren't I clever? I'm just weird. I've just got a very good memory for things that I'm interested in. And, if it doesn't interest me, there's no way you can get me to focus on it, you know?
Yeah.
I just don't care. It's like... Being a man of a certain age, if I spend most of the summer saying to people, no, I don't like cricket. Thanks anyway. you could tell me anything about a car and I'd believe you, because I've got, you know, what I know about cars, Kevin, you could write in the back of a postage stamp, mate.
Yeah, same. but it's a good point that you make, though, because we were talking about this off air, if you like to use that sort of phrase. But earlier we were talking about the fact, what makes you such a good interviewer, if you like, is the fact that there's a genuine interest in, you know, you're asking questions you want to know the answer to, as Paul Bestall. You're not asking questions you think the listeners want to find out. Do you know what I mean? And it turns out that the listeners do also want to know the answers to those questions. So I think that's why it works.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. Pulling the curtain back a little, I never write down questions at all. I'll just have bullet points or things if I, you know, just to keep my mind sharp and keep me on track. But I never bothered with questions ever because I've always been a conversationalist in regards to finding out what makes people tick or what works where or certain stories and certain experiences. Because I think one of the things I always want is I want to hear somebody tell me their story or tell me about something.
Yeah.
What people don't want is me to tell them what I think they think, and therefore nobody agrees with what anybody thinks because nobody's interested in that.
Yeah. it's a funny thing. It's kind of on par with what you're saying there. It's like, and you'll know this yourself with your work on the Ghost Story Guys, because obviously this podcast, this amazing podcast that you do, you tend to, with the exception of me, interview people who are like, you know, they tend to have a, you know, they're driven on a subject like we were talking earlier about, his name's just gone out of my head. Who were we talking about before? The gentleman who's just about to release a documentary on Dogman.
Paul Sinclair.
Paul Sinclair, thank you. Yeah, you generally interview people who, you know, they're driven on a topic, they know the ins and outs of a duck's backside. And what I find fascinating is, and I say this quite often to Beck and my partner, is it's very easy, and you will know this from what you receive with the Ghost Story Guys, to spot a genuine story from a fake story that's been submitted in the paranormal realm, if you like. And you know what? This is why some of the best and most terrifying stories or experiences, should I say, that I've read are literally like two paragraphs. And they're so succinct that it's almost like they're being told to you in a pub. You know, there's no need for, like, I'll get a 10-page email off someone for the Dark Paranormal and immediately I'll see the length and think, this is blag.
Yeah.
There's no, it'll start, for example, with, one cold, windy November morning, and I'm like, no. And then someone else will send in something which is like four paragraphs long, and it'll be like, last year my nan died, and when I went downstairs, something will happen which I'll think, that's genuine, that's happened. The succinctness of it is, has given it an air of authenticity which is hard to fake. It's fascinating. I just found the whole... I find the paranormal fascinating anyway. I find ufology fascinating, you know. Even though now it seems to be coming a little bit more, it's probably us sort of thing.
Yeah.
But it's also fascinating now from a different element in terms of how people communicate their stories to you, you know. It's an ever-evolving thing. And like, I never thought for one moment, despite my interest in the paranormal, that I'd get to the point in life where I'd be able to have a pretty good gauge on whether someone was telling me the truth or not via an email. But I have now. I've got a good radar for it. It's an interesting, weird fact.
Yeah. Well, I think it is. It's experience, Kev. You get used to it. You can tell when people are pulling your leg or exaggerating, or it's just what they think they should write.
Yes.
Or they've just been really cheeky and stole it off Reddit or Creepypasta or whatever, and just thought, oh, nobody will know this.
Yeah.
Think again, pal. And and so sometimes I think because we're so used to seeing dramatized events or something being portrayed as based on true events, you can always tell when they've flowered it up.
Definitely 100%. And I'm quite honest with the Dark Paranormal listeners. I say, you know, if somebody sent me a story which I think is phenomenal, I will edit the story, but I will not add anything to it. You know, I won't add an event, like, as in, you know, any paranormal event in the Dark Paranormal, they're what's being told to me. But if they put, like, I walked down the stairs and all the cutlery was thrown against the wall or whatever, you know, I'll make that sound dramatic. But the facts of the matter are, that took place. I am trying to build suspense. And like I said earlier, for the simple reason, I do want people to be scared. I love the idea of fear of the paranormal, because I do think it is something that, you know, there's a reason why we run up the stairs of a night when we turn the lights off. It's a magnificent thing that I can't put my finger on, and I love it, but I'm terrified of it at the same time.
Yeah, and it's something that's been with us for eons, from the earliest days of the written word, Kev, for whatever reason. I mean, obviously people will always, you know, when they point out, I think the oldest ghost story written was it Pliny the Younger or Pliny the Elder, which is that famous story about the guy that buys the abandoned villa and gets disturbed at night by that rattling of chains and the spectre wandering around, and then
that's in the Usborne book.
Yes. So it shows you that, you know, these stories have been around for the best part of at least 2,000 years, and they probably were, and there were stories of magic and myth when we look back at the stories of Mesopotamia and ancient Egypt and the Greeks and the Romans. They all had stories of this thing. So this need to believe in an afterlife, or that there are spectres wandering the earth for whatever reason of all varieties and shapes and sizes, is something that it can't be dismissed as just delusional fantasy, because it seems to be the only thing that has stayed with us through all the civilizations that have been and gone, like the waves crashing onto the beach, Kev. You know,
What an excellent point, because if you think about it, and, you know, without being too controversial on the subject, but you're right, like, you know, we use BC AD now, because of Christ, because of Catholicism, but ghosts existed before Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, religions have literally come and gone. But the idea of an afterlife has remained. It's fascinating. It's truly fascinating. The thing that, like, it doesn't keep me awake at night by any stretch of the imagination, but sometimes I get a bit baffled by life itself. This makes me sound like I'm an absolute nutter now, but you know, I have skeptical friends, obviously. There's a lot of skeptics out there, and quite, you know, rightly so, and we have good debates, and sometimes we don't have good debates, we have arguments and but what is also more magical than like us talking now, you know, the fact, and this sounds very simplistic, and it's clearly from somebody who didn't do science at school, but I'm not running on batteries. Do you know what I mean? There's a sentience within me that is able to recognize me as a person, and, you know, it just baffles me, life in general. Like, as in, why, not necessarily why are we here, but I don't know. I could very, very easily fall into, because like yourself, you read all the 14 topics that are going on, and you'll dip in and out of things. And the one that's got me thinking, more than likely, is this simulation theory. You know, the idea of we've evolved so much that it's a simulation within a simulation within a simulation within a simulation. And there was when I was thinking, it's probably all nonsense, that there was a scientist who turned around and said, the reason why it's probably nonsense, because in order for that to take place, the hard drive that would be required to hold such information would need to be, and they came up with this amount of, this size of the hard drive, basically, saying, like, you know, it'd be like it, light years across, sort of thing.
Mm.
And then weirdly, about 3 days later, I was watching something, and it was more or less the size of, is it Boots Void? Or whatever it's called. Is it Boots or Bootes or something? Void?
Yes.
This area in the sky where there's nothing.
Mm.
And the measurement was more or less what this guy had said, that's what you need the hard drive to be. My brain nearly exploded. I wanted to try and find my dad and just hide. I was like, we are in a situation after all. But anyway. I think, you know, I love thinking about what could be, you know. Maybe, do ghosts exist? I don't know. Do I? Who knows? Who honestly knows? Do I believe they exist? I wouldn't rule it out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when anybody ever says anything like that, I say, well, the principles of skepticism based on that belief is fine. However, the first law of thermodynamics is that energy can't be destroyed, and we are energy.
Yeah.
So where does it go?
Yeah. It's got to go somewhere. But then I also play devil's advocate with that. You know, like I'll shoot down some of my own arguments, because I'm sure you, especially of all people, will have seen how some people have tried to bend quantum physics into the paranormal, incorrectly so. You know, like they're saying, oh no, quantum physics has proved the paranormal. Like, no, it hasn't. It hasn't. It really hasn't. You basically don't understand quantum physics. And even quantum physicists say the infamous saying, if you think you know quantum physics, you don't know quantum physics.
Yes.
So for someone who's not a quantum physicist to say it's proved the paranormal exists. Like we were talking earlier, again, off air, I get, because of what I do, I host paranormal podcasts, I am a believer. Do I know they exist? No. Do I believe they exist? Yeah, I do. So therefore, I get sent a lot of photos and stuff by friends and family, and they're always of dust. They're always of orbs. And you think I'm going to go absolutely bananas over them and go, oh, my God, can I have you on the show and we can talk about this dust? And he's like, no, it's dust.
Yeah. My next email is from Mr. Sheen.
Yeah, Ken Dodd. But it is a fascinating one. It's like, yeah, one of the I love, there's some things which are, there's a thing called Seriality. Have you heard of Seriality?
No, I haven't.
It's this guy, and I've got no names because I am not you, and you are like the messiah when it comes to absorbing knowledge. I read something interesting and take the bullet points, and you never include names or places or anything like that. But basically, I'm sure it's called seriality. But anyway, the essence of it is it apparently the guy who came up with this theory, it drove him mad.
Mm-hmm.
I think he ended up, committing Harry Carey, as they say, or whatever. And so basically, it's the idea that things happen in sequence and patterns exist. Patterns are part of nature. And randomness is not random. So, but it comes down to even the level. This guy took it to the level of, right, I've seen four blue cars in a row. That means the next one must be red.
Mm.
And it would be, and it started to mess with his brain a bit because he was looking for patterns everywhere. Right, I've seen three people wearing glasses. So the next one's going to not be wearing glasses, but might wear a hat. And he ended, he started seeing these patterns everywhere. And it's a really interesting thing. It's kind of like, if you look at, if you go to like, not that many people do this, but if you go to certain like casinos, or if you go to, if you play certain slot machine games and it's got a roulette on and it'll show you the last like 30 numbers that have come out. And if you look, it's the whole gambler's fallacy. If you just tossed five heads in a row. So what's the odds of you tossing heads next? It's still 50-50.
Yeah.
And that's the, but the thing is, this is where the seriality comes into it. It throws all that on its head, the gambler's fallacy. It's deep maths, and I've got no idea how it all works, but it's a genuinely interesting thing. I think it bent my head at one point. I remember standing at the traffic lights one point after reading about it and being like, hold on, there's three Aldis at the traffic lights. I was like, so that means I shouldn't see another Audi for a while. And I was stood there. I purposely didn't cross the road and didn't see another Audi for like 10 minutes. And I started to freak out. I was like, what's happening? But yeah, seriality. I'm sure it's called seriality. But yeah, I'll have to try and send you that privately when I find a link on the guide. But it was really interesting.
Mm. I think it is, when you start delving into these particular subjects, it does make you wonder how people have the mental capacity to comprehend what they're dealing with. Prime example is that of John Nash, whose famous life was portrayed in the film A Beautiful Mind.
Yes.
And I suppose the old cliche goes, Kev, that genius is very close to madness in disguise, essentially. And it does take you aback sometimes when you look at some of these concepts and the people that have pulled them, and when we look at people in the past, you think, well, they don't have the knowledge and the resources we do today, and yet they were still able to make incredible discoveries like Newton and Pythagoras things that were created by the Aztecs and the Egyptians, and how did the Romans know to make metal pipes, and these things that it, when you start thinking about it can just melt your brain, like you said,
because batteries in Iraq wasn't it like from Mesopotamia, even, sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's these kind of arguments like, well, you know, nobody, the Greeks and the Romans and the Egyptians, yes, they were all brilliant sailors, but nobody went anywhere outside the Mediterranean. You're like, yeah, all right, mate.
Yeah.
Of course they did. They went so far, they went, oh, let's stop.
Yeah, exactly. We've had all the bananas.
You know, it's all like the Vikings only went south. They didn't go west. Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
Of course they didn't.
I'm sure there's like some sort of weird fact. I'm going to say fact. Take that in, like, you know, with a pinch of, well, with a massive spade of salt. But that, like, a lot of, there's a heavy Greek influx into Ireland at some point for some reason. I've read this somewhere and it stuck with me. So let every listener take that as fact from here. Everyone in Ireland is really of a Greek descent. No, yeah. I read something around it, and that was why it's mainly dark hair and brown eyes and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Really interesting thing.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things that, you know, I think the more we learn about things like DNA, as time has developed and the leaps and bounds that have come in that particular field of discipline, Kev, over the last 40 years, is remarkable now that you can essentially look at somebody's DNA now and know what they're allergic to or what their kids might be. And it just shows you sometimes, just you look at that and where we are now, and DNA is baffling to us now, and we deal with it, we're able to break it down. You had people 70 years ago working on this stuff, and they had none of the computing power or the resources that we had, and yet they were still able to sort of decipher it and understand what it was and what it meant and why it was different in different species and chromosomes. And you're just like, good God.
Yeah, different level of mind. And I think that's, you know, there's like a belief out there. When I say there's a belief, you know, there's a theory out there that we're going to grow due to the, you know, the ever growing technological advances that's going on. We're going to grow dumber. You know, it's similar to like the less you use a muscle, the more it wastes away. And there's an idea that the more that AI starts, not necessarily AI, but, you know, as technology starts to do things that we would have previously had to use our brain for, we'll lose the power to do it. And it's believable. It's, you know, it's believievable to someone as gullible as me, but, you know.
Well, it's like that really bad joke, isn't it? I can't believe gullible's not in the thesaurus. So, you could look at that in regards to paranormal research and parapsychology, Kev.
Yeah.
I think sometimes because people are presented a particular version of it in popular culture these days, they seem to think that that's all that goes on because it's all that they see, whereas the deep thinkers and the researchers and the people that really break it down to an analytical level are still out there. They're just not on television. Whereas 30, 40 years ago, people like William Roll and Hans Holzer and Tony Cornell and Guy Light and Playfair would be on TV because they were the most well-known parapsychologists in the world at that time.
Yeah.
Now, we don't get those academically minded people because apparently they don't make good television, which is a matter of opinion. So,
yeah.
I think it's public perception can often be skewed by popular culture making it so you only have to look at things on social media and certain television programs where they go, oh, we've got the number one trend on Twitter, this particular program, but hardly anybody watches it.
Yeah.
And yet if you look at certain social media apps, you'll think, oh, well, that's really popular, but then the viewing figures show you that it's not.
Yeah, it's all skewed. It's definitely all skewed. And you're right in what you're saying. I mean, relatively recently, within like the last 6 years, did I discover Colin Wilson.
Yes.
And he's a revelation, an absolute revelation. I read The Occult, and I'm sure you've got a copy, but the Occult is a thick tome.
Yes.
It is for somebody who doesn't read. I'm going to say, I can read, you know. I'm not happy that I can't get two potatoes together.
Yeah.
But I normally fall asleep after four pages, but that book genuinely changed my life. Because the first part of it, although he was tasked to write a book on the occult, and he didn't want to do it, apparently, first, it's the first four or five or six chapters. It's basically philosophy. He's a modern day philosopher.
And yeah.
It's, you know, the things he talks about within it are mind blowing to whether you're a believer or a skeptic. And it's like you're saying, it's this sort of intellect that that we're not privy to these days as the general public. You know, if somebody looked handsome or somebody looked pretty enough, they'll appear on TV as a parapsychologist, and that's as far as we get. We don't get a Colin Wilson anymore.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, that's what I mean when I think about two of the people I've spoken to on this show, Kev, Evelyn Hollow and Morgan Knudsen, who are both throwbacks to that kind of era of intelligent, articulate, knowledgeable researchers who don't fall into the cliches and the standard tropes that we've been exposed to over the last 20 years, you know? And, yeah, I mean, I still dip my toe into what's on television these days, primarily just to, you know, just to keep my eye on things and see who's what and who's rising where, and can't believe that person's come back into it after what they did 10 years ago, you know, that kind of thing. Which always reminds me of a famous psychic who's no longer with us, a gentleman called Colin Fry.
Oh, God, yeah.
And Mr. Fry was caught several times faking it. My favourite Colin Fry story is, and I still couldn't believe that people were doing this in the modern era, because it was one of the classic confidence tricks of the old spiritualism movement, was the lights off and then all of a sudden a trumpet starts playing, and then he got caught, somebody turned the light on and he was stood in the room playing a trumpet. You know? And I mean, that all happened and he still ended up getting a television show.
Yeah, because it's all about, and this is the thing which is annoying. I mean, you know what, there's a lot, it's got its detractors, but there's a lot to be said for Most Haunted in its initial incarnation anyway, I think. I remember I was quite young, about 18 maybe, when they done the first Most Haunted Live.
Yeah.
And everyone in my house, I was living in my dad's, they were all out. So I got myself a bottle of wine, chippy tea, lights off, TV on, and sat in front of the telly. And they'd done everything that I would expect someone to do in that first one. Like, it was, they put a vet in a room on her own with a camera, and it had never been done before. You know, it's done all the time. And it was amazing TV. Nothing happened, but it was amazing TV, and it was basically real Ghost Watch.
Yeah,
you know, that's what it was, but without Mr. Pipes. And it was amazing TV, and I think unfortunately if you think about it, like, Most Haunted became so big, they were on Saturday Night Live. They were getting skittered on Saturday Night Live. They were huge. And then we get your Bagans and we get all this. And can I just say, the one thing, I mean, I know there's a lot of Ghost Adventurers fans out there and they go nuts for Bagans and then all that carry on. I'm not one for, I've watched a few of them. Some of them have been like, oh, that's quite interesting. But more about the history of the places and the stories and ghost stories behind them and et cetera. What I always find really hysterical when I do watch one, though, is, if nothing has taken place, all of a sudden, Mr. Bagans seems to get possessed and want to punch one certain guy in the crew. And it's like he'll do the commentary over the top, and it's like, I can't see the fella's name, it's like Peter or something. And it's like, it's at this point, I just wanted to punch Peter in the face. And it's like, all this is like Peter Gets Battered, season 12. But I do like, you know, I watch them because the backstories can be great at these places, you know, the real authentic sort of, it's like, to one thing that I read in a really good article once in 14 times, and it's this sort of stuff that really still keeps me hooked on the subject of ghosts. It was a really good article that someone had put together. I forget the name because, like I say, I keep the bullet points, not the names. But they basically had kept, they found records of this place in Scotland. I think it was a castle. And basically, there was a news clipping from like 1890 where people had reported seeing a woman in red running down one of the runways or whatever of this castle. And then in the 1920s, there was a news clipping of people reporting seeing a woman slightly transparent in pink.
Yes.
Down the thing. And then in the 1950s, there was people sensing someone running past them like a breeze. And it was as if this stone tape theory apparition was dissolving over time. But it was kind of like almost proven within these 40-year apart news articles. And it was fascinating to see, you know, it was like, it was a factual thing. Like, these news reports were there in the press in 14 times. Like, the way that this thing seems to have dissipated over 100 years. And that's what still keeps me hooked, things like that.
Yeah, that's really rung a bell. I'm trying to think what it is, but I yeah, that's one of those, because there are some, when I've spoken to Ruth Roper Wilder is a prime example, Kev.
Yeah.
Of stories where people were seeing something 100 years ago and now they just hear it.
Yes, exactly.
Which is one of those aspects that you think is that falling into, as you say there, the stone tape theory, that these are recordings that have a certain lifespan?
Yeah.
Or is it that...
I think it's just that. I mean, think about your VHSs. Back
yeah.
in the day,
yeah.
they would eventually wear out. You know, they would all eventually wear out. They would never last forever. Do you know what I mean? Even you get one from Blockbuster or wherever, and it'd be knackered because it'd been watched that many times.
Yeah.
And I think that's all it is. Whatever the magic ingredients that are needed, whether it be a certain environmental weather or a certain type of rock or a certain type of this or that or the other, they've all got a finite span of energy to provide if they're going to reenact this thing. But, yeah.
So. Well, I think it's one of those things as well, because often when it comes to the paranormal especially, I find it surprising that people are very entrenched in it. It has to be this type of thing. Whereas I think if you've got a fairly brief span of certain hauntings, Kev, you know that they're not the same things.
Yeah.
You know, the ghost of a lady running down the runway in a castle is not the same as to what was happening in Enfield, which is not the same that's happening in somebody's house where their cats come back to remind them that they still love them and jump on the bed. And it's not the same as the footsteps walking in a pub somewhere down south. These are all very different phenomena. They can't really be the same thing because they're all different things going on.
It's an excellent point. And you know what? I've said this recently on a show, and you're the guy to do it. If so, I'm going to challenge you now. I'll be honest, it's an epic task. So feel free to fail. But my point that I was going to make is, we're still using terminology about the paranormal that has been used for 40 plus years, or 30 plus years at least. You know, we're still, in terms of, like what we're saying, stone tape theory. Is it a residual haunting? Is it a sentient haunting? These things we need an updated vocabulary, because, and I don't mean necessarily to go into the realms of where everyone, you know, oh, well, we've got the hat man, and now we've got the shadow man, and now we've got the cape man, and, you know, not, but there are differences in these hauntings. There are differences in what these things are. Like Colin Wilson's one about, I think he was talking to Guy Lyon Playfair.
Yes.
I think they were talking on a train or something, and they were discussing a poltergeist case somewhere. And one of the two, and I can't remember who it was, you'll know, had a theory that basically, because as we all know, that poltergeist-esque happenings allegedly happen around pubescent teenagers because there's a lot of pent-up energy and aggression or anger or whatever, and there's a lot of emotion in the household, and that energy, allegedly, this theory was, would create almost like balls within the home.
Yes.
And an entity passing through those houses would kick those balls, and the balls would then knock something off a shelf and burst and would appear as water on the floor, which is why pools of water would often be found around poltergeist cases.
Yeah.
And it was such a fascinating theory. It was like, oh my God, how does your brain, you know, to go back that many steps, like, right, okay, if something's flew off a shelf, there's a pool of water. Is it theoretical that something, so thinly we can't see it or make it out, membrane of energy, can be witnessed by an entity of some sort who, just like a child, has decided to give it a volley.
Yeah.
And it's bounced and hit a statue or whatever, or a figurine, and then burst.
Mm.
And it was such an interesting theory. It's always stuck with me.
Yeah. It was Guy Lyon Playfair, that.
Oh, was it? Was that him and Kim with that? I didn't really do.
Well, Playfair specialised in poltergeist cases, because obviously if you've never had the chance, he wrote a brilliant book about his experiences dealing with Brazilian cases.
That, you know what? I know of the book.
Yeah.
And I haven't read it, but I know it deals with a lot with fires, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Fires being started. And...
Yeah. There's a case where a girl was murdered, allegedly, by one in the favelas. And they are very odd. I mean, when you come to that kind of thing, once again, you know, like you mentioned there, Kevin, by fires, it's one of those things that doesn't happen in every poltergeist case. It happens in certain ones. Amherst in Canada is a prime example of that that was going on with Esther Cox, I think her name was.
Esther Cox, yeah.
And so that one's a prime example. Whereas Enfield, there weren't any fires.
Yeah.
The Black Monk of Pontefract, which obviously Wilson investigated firsthand.
Yeah.
That didn't do fires. It did lots of other things. That one of my favourite aspects of that particular case is those dancing gloves, which is terrifying.
Yeah.
You know, if you see a pair of white gloves dancing around a door frame, you'd be like, whoa. But it also had clearly a deep, dark sense of humour, because it poured a jug of milk over somebody's head who said there was no such thing as ghosts at the kitchen table. So,
yeah. You know what, it's those, like, and the thing is, those two parts that you've mentioned there, they'll be a bit foreign to people who know the case but don't know the case.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's similar with Enfield. It's like, it's for me, it's the peripheral stuff which I find the most terrifying. It's not necessarily Janet. Is a really, really... You know, the scariest part of those infamous photos of Janet,
yeah,
be it jumping from the bed or be it levitating from the bed, whichever way you want to look at it.
Mm.
The interesting thing about those photos is not Janet in midair. The interesting thing about those photographs is the curtain.
Yes.
Wrapping itself around.
Yeah.
Something. That's, you know, it's these things which are, I do believe, I don't know, you know, I'm sure there's many variants of them, but I do believe in some sort of malevolent trickster.
Mm.
That, and the thing is with tricksters, like magicians, it's all about deception. It's all about focusing your attention elsewhere whilst the real trick goes on.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I think that photograph's a prime example of that.
Mm.
Everyone's focused on the girl flying in midair screaming. And in the meanwhile, if you look at the next photo afterwards where she's landing, the curtain's wrapped around something.
Yeah.
You know, it's I love that, those sort of peripheral things.
Yeah. Yeah, very much. I mean, and it is what it is with those kinds of things, because sometimes, especially with Enfield, there was so much going on and so many different types of phenomenon that when people try and disprove the case, they'll always focus on the fact that Playfair and Gross caught them cheating, mucking about. But they still recorded 1,500 incidents, and there's tons. Like I've always said, somebody wants to tell me that the girls were faking at Enfield. Can they explain how they tricked the police when the chair slid across the kitchen table in front of them?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And we're focusing on these two girls. Fine, that's fine. But you can't just say, well, I've explained this bit, so everything's wrong. Because that's not how it works.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. And I'm not being funny. If you manage to get a job in the police and a young girl can fool you that, you know, make you believe that something paranormal is happening, you shouldn't be working for the police. Do you know what I mean? It's like, if you can't deduce what's gone on there, then you're in the wrong job.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, another one is when Gross is on the girls in the girls' bedroom upstairs, and they're both sat with him, and he gets hit in the face with a cardboard box. Well, who's on that then? Is he that gullible that he didn't know, and he's one of the girls, get up off the bed, walk across the room, pick a box up, hit him in the face with it?
Yeah, exactly. You know what? You know, I don't know why this is just me now. It just jumped into my head, but it's kind of it's a personal weird experience to do with, you know, just talking about. So, you know, the just one of those things, or the Mary Rose Barrington.
Yeah.
But the idea, obviously, for those, I'm sure those people listening to this show are fully aware of what it is. But the main premise is that we don't, or when I say we, I mean the general public, don't give enough credence to actual paranormal experiences because you put it down to just one of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And you may be surrounded by them all the time, or not all the time, but, you know, they may happen once every 4 years.
Yeah.
It may be a paranormal experience, but you will put it down because it's then not being followed up with a haunting or a smashing of a plate.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of when my brother-in-law was living in my dad's house with my sister and me and my dad, the four of us were living in the house. He is, well, he was a bin man at the time. He's a big fella. And I know people often, you know, he's a big fella and he's 6'4", doesn't believe in ghosts, to try and add some credence to it. But this is, you know, that's what he's like. Anyway, he comes out to me one morning and goes, "Feel my heart." And like, that's something someone like him doesn't say.
Mm.
Anyway, so I put my hand to his chest and his heart pounding, like pounding. And he's like, he's smiling and giggling while he's saying it. And I went, "Wow, what's up?" And he went, "Come look at this." And we went into the bedroom and I'm looking and the bed sheet basically is pulled back. And that's it. And I'm like, "What?" And he said, "I've just made that bed." He said, I've put both pillows down. I've turned around to grab this pillow. And he's got the pillow in his hand that I'm just about to put in between the two pillows. He said, "And that's how the bed is when I turned around." And I was like, "Seriously?" He was like, "Yeah, yeah." And he laughed it off, and I laughed it off. And I said, "Have you caught the corner of the bed on something?" But it was pulled from the other side. Do you know what I mean? Pulled from the top left of the bed down. And again, just one of those things. But what the reason that I'm saying about these just one of those things is, because the main one for me, which makes me think, what in the living F was that, is when I used to work in a contact centre, I was a call monitor. So, you know, you listen to people's calls and you score them out or whatever.
Hmm.
And anyway, now and again, if we were under quota, because we do it off a recording system, but now and again, if we were running behind, we do live monitorings.
Yeah.
And I was listening to this woman, lovely woman called Jackie, and she was doing left and right. And she says to this woman, she's put an order through for a new mobile phone or something for this woman.
Hmm.
And she says, "Okay, are you ready for me to—" I'm listening to this and watching her. I can see her talking as I'm listening, and I'm marking this sheet. And she says to the woman, "Are you ready for me to give you your mobile number?" The woman says, "Oh, no, just let me go and grab a pen." And you know, to put the phone down on the side.
Hmm.
Then you hear, as clear as day, "Judas." Right?
Yeah.
No word of a lie. And I'm looking at Jackie, and Jackie hasn't responded. She's made no... She's not reacted to this noise at all, to this word.
Yeah.
And the woman comes back and goes, "Hello." And Jackie, back in the form, "Hi, yeah, it's 075, da 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 da." She just carries on. Anyway, I had it on the recording, and I said, "Come over here." I said, "Did you hear this?" And played it back. And when you play it back, "I'll just go and get a pen." Judas. Clear as effing day.
Wow.
And I've never seen someone turn white like Jackie did. She had her hand to her mouth and was going, "I didn't hear that. That wasn't in my earpiece." And to this day, I have no idea what it was. But it was the word Judas. It was as clear as day. And even now, I've just got a shiver. Maybe because it's getting dark as we're talking. But, you know, sincerely, like, there was about 12 of us in the end around the computer listening to it on the replay. And just can't explain it. Can't explain it. Just one of those things.
Yeah. It is strange, like you say, people will, I think, of a certain sceptical mind, will just dismiss anything. As soon as you started mentioning that subject, Kev, there was two experiences that were shared with me by friends that both times I just thought, I don't know how you just think that's nothing to be perturbed by.
About.
One of them was a friend, and I remember going round to the house on the weekend. He said, the other night was right weird. I said, "Oh, right, what's up?" He said, "Oh, the cat kept jumping on and off the bed all night.
Mm.
And I said, "Oh, right. Okay." He said, "Yeah." And then I got up in the morning and the cat was sat outside.
Okay.
And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Cat hadn't been in the house all night. There was no way for a cat to get in the house. There wasn't another cat. Their cat wasn't in the house. And they checked everywhere, couldn't see it. Cat was fine, nothing. Never happened again." And he just went, "Yeah, it was a bit weird, that." I went, "A bit weird?"
That baffles me, Ed. You can't be a skeptic and say something like that and say, "Weird, run it," and go, no, not weird, impossible.
Yeah.
Unless you change your belief system.
Or consider the possibilities, as you say, that we don't know everything about everything.
Yeah, I think the power of the mind is, one, something we've yet to know. You know, I think similar to the oceans and...
Mm.
We know more about space, arguably, than the oceans, or whatever the saying is.
Yeah.
But I do believe, you know, this whole, you know, that saying, the infamous saying. In fact, my mother used to say this, and this is a weird, it's not necessarily the same thing, but you know, like that saying, if you look into the darkness, don't be surprised when it looks back.
Yes.
Or whatever. My mum used to say, if you want to see a ghost, you'll see a ghost.
Mm.
And obviously she died before me as an adult would have liked to have sat her down and said, what do you mean by that?
Mm.
And I still wonder whether she means, if you believe so much in it that you'll make out everything as a ghost, or literally, if you believe enough, one will, you know, one will happily look back at you, mm. sort of thing.
Mm.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think it's that kind of concept as well, Kev. When you hear experiences from people where they've been on a tour of somewhere and there's a party of 30 people.
Yeah.
And two people will see somebody who they think is an actor or somebody dressed funny. And nobody else in that party sees them, notices them, even if this character might walk through the group, around the group, be stood where everybody must be able to see it in the group.
Yeah.
And yet only two or even one person may see something a bit peculiar and mention yeah. it at the end of the tour. And it, I think it comes down to that, because as we grapple with these potentials and these concepts and what could be, is it that only certain people have the frequency to respond to it, to see it? Because we all know, as we were saying about energy and things like that, everybody's brains are wired different. That's why people are very yeah. talented in different fields. And if they weren't, then we'd be up the creek without a paddle in regards to...
Well, nothing would be made, would it? Nothing
well, exactly. There'd be no culture, there'd be no enrichment, there'd be no art, there'd be no books, there'd be no anything that could entertain us, because we would all be on a default setting that we would all be sort of autonomous, wouldn't we? We'd just be very Soylent Green. And so it's one of those questions I've always baffled with, because I remember speaking to Ruth about one of the experiences that was shared with her, which was a party of four people in a car driving along, and two of them, I think it was the front passenger and the back driver's side passenger, both saw this figure walk into the road and screamed.
Wow.
And so the driver went, braked. Everybody went, oh, bloody hell. And they're like, what are you screaming for, you idiot? What are you done that for? I said, didn't you see that? Didn't you see that? And the other two people in the car hadn't seen
it. Didn't see it? Oh, wow. Because they're in a different mindset. You know what? I've had this theory, right? And you of all people, will probably tell me if this already exists elsewhere.
Mm.
But if it has, I've never heard of it. So in my mind, I've made it up. But I might not have. So it's this, you know, you often hear people talk, and when somebody tells you a ghost story, I'm talking like in a pub or in a social setting, often if we were telling ghost stories and you know, something happened, or we were doing the Ouija board, or we were talking about when this happened, and then there's always something, you know, something flew off the shelf, something happened. And I've always had this thought that I wonder if maybe, if you get a group of people together, right, let's say there's two levels in your brain. On one side, you've got what you think can happen. Mm. And on the other side, you've got what you know 100% can happen, right? Now, 9 times out of 10, they meet. They're completely level. So, like, you think you can open that door with your hand. You know you can. You reach out, you open the door opens.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about the paranormal, what you think can happen, like, you know, I think ghosts might be able to be a thing, so it's up here, but what I know can happen is actually down here. But when you do things like, you know, talk about ghosts, or you do the Ouija board, or I think what you know actually can happen starts to raise a bit, because you're being more and more convinced.
Mm.
And I think eventually, if enough people are in a room, say doing a Ouija board, say doing a seance, say talking about ghosts, sharing ghost stories, if enough people are in a room and even two of those people's levels meet, something will happen.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, an energy is formed, like a bolt of lightning. Something will fly off a shelf, or do you know what I mean? I don't know, because we don't know. We just don't know.
No, I mean, well, that's very similar to what happened with the Philip experiment, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, yeah.
Because they
point, actually.
Yeah, because they set themselves out the intention to create a ghost, and they did.
Yeah.
So
I mean, arguably, is that a tool path?
Well, exactly. There is always. I mean, it's one of those things, Kev. I think sometimes people who aren't well versed in the paranormal will just fix anything, like people constantly go on about doppelgangers when they're probably talking about voyeurs.
Yeah,
you know. Yeah. But it's just like, once again, it's one of those buzz terms. I mean, there are so many intrinsically strange things about the paranormal, like the Hat Man, for example. And I've always said this, because one of the arguments against this is that people are simply sleep paralysis, and the sleep paralysis is creating this image of a particular type of person. I don't understand how that's a valid explanation, because if it was 1950, right, and people going, oh, I keep having these dreams of this bloke wearing a hat standing in the corner of the room, I'd go, fine, because everybody's wearing a bloody fedora.
Bloody good point, yeah.
Now, why is nobody being assailed by the baseball man? Baseball cat man, you know? I mean, when's the last time you saw somebody walking through Liverpool City Centre wearing a fedora, Kev?
It was probably me.
I've got one as well. I've got my straw Panama.
yeah. Well, that's what I have. But to be honest, that was just for a festival, so we didn't have to wash me out. But it's an excellent point. You know, this isn't a caveat to that, because obviously the Hat Man is a very different sort of kettle of fish. And again, getting back to your point before, and I agreed with you and said we need to update all our terminologies on what we're classifying these things as.
Mm.
I'm not necessarily saying like the Hat Man is the new old hag, for example. Or maybe it is. You know, maybe things do change as culture changes or whatever else. But interestingly, there's a place where John Lennon used to go to school. Funny enough, name dropping. Blackburn House, which is just over the road from us here.
Yeah.
And they do ghost tours. And we were on a ghost tour there once. And it was really well done, really well put together. Not an happen, but a few motion sensors did go off, and you know that could be mice or whatever else.
Mm.
But one of the interesting stories about the place is that the ghost that is seen most frequently on this particular floor is of a lad dressed in 1990s gear, like a Ben Sherman, jeans and like a crew cut. And it was a lad who apparently, sadly, like got off his face on drugs and fell asleep in the grounds of the place in the winter and froze to death. Yeah, but it's interesting that, like, you know, I don't know what to do. I would assume, and this is the even more getting back into, well, I'm going to say getting back into, we haven't touched on it, but you know, like, if I would see that ghost, that would not be a ghost.
No, exactly.
I would not recognize that as a ghost. So when you're walking around a supermarket, I wonder how many ghosts you see. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it could be known. Mary died last week, but you don't know who the friggin' hell Mary is. But she's looking at fish in aisle three.
Well, that is. I think it's only when something seems out of place that you consider it might be something unusual. Whereas I've flippantly mentioned this. I remember speaking with Amanda Woolmer about this. And I was saying, where are all the disco ghosts? You know what I mean?
Where are they?
I mean, is it that kind of thing that, are they just not wandering about? I mean, if you live in a major city, with the greatest respect, you're going to see all kinds of people dressed in all kinds of fashions. These days, anything goes, really. If you're into it, you wear it.
Yeah.
It's not like the old days where everybody was regimented and you were a mod or a rocker or you were a punk or a hippie or whatever. Now there's a real sort of freedom for people to flip and change and wear what fashion they fancy wearing on a particular day of the week.
No, you're quite right, yeah.
So it's one of those things, like you say, that when you're talking about that particular haunting, people aren't going to spot that, because that just looks like a guy. Because to be fair, other than perhaps a haircut and maybe how baggy the clothes were, you wouldn't know that person was out of time.
Exactly. And this is why, you know, if I had to put a flag in the ground of when people try and differentiate between residual and sentient spirits, if you like, I would say anything that you're seeing that's got clothes on, it's residual.
Yeah.
Unless it's talking to you, you know, and in which case it's probably a personal spirit of some sort. Mm. Or it's malevolent.
Mm.
Because like the old argument, unless it's a residual, like a stone tape theory thing, why would it have clothes? Do you know what? There are no ghost clothes, because the argument could be he could take that ghost shirt off, leave it there, and walk away.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've got a ghost shirt.
Yeah.
You know, so I think if somebody sees a ghost and it's a person, unless there's an interaction, it's residual.
Mm.
And therefore, technically nothing to be afraid of in my mind.
Mm.
You know, I'd still run the other bloody way. But my point is, where there's no brain and there's no sentience, there's no fear. You know, it doesn't know you, it can't see you. And I think if it does, if it is clothed and it is interacting with you, it can only be malevolent.
Hmm.
You know, or you've created it yourself, as in like through trauma or through the loss of a loved one, you're trying to comfort yourself through your dad visiting you or your mum visiting you or whatever else. Mm. But if it's complete, if someone you don't know comes up, walks through a wall, is fully clothed and has a conversation with you, you get a priest, because that's not a nice person. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that opens up a whole world of things, because that then works on the principle. And this is once again one of these things that sometimes I hear people say outrageously strange things about the paranormal, such as, well, only things with souls can be a ghost. And you're like, well, how does that? So therefore, we have to presume that planes and cars have souls then, because there are
excellent point.
Thousands of reports of people seeing ghost planes. Obviously, where I live, ghost planes are a regular, pardon the pun, regular flaps here, Kev, with especially around the Peak District. And I remember one guy who lived outside of Chesterfield saw one, and he was poo-pooed by the local media. And so in a follow-up interview, he kindly gave them his war CV and how many flights he'd been on and where he'd flown as bomber command, and basically said, if anybody knows where a plane is, it's me.
Yeah,
I know where I saw. So and you get really strange ones when people see a house or a building, you know, or an abandoned cottage, and then they come back and it's not there anymore.
Yeah.
Well, what's that? And then people, oh, well, it's a time slip. Well, how do you know it's a time slip?
Yeah.
Often I think people are very quick to put certain phenomena in certain boxes, and that's it. As I was saying about doppelgangers and boygers and things, that's it as far as they're concerned. The Hat Man is sleep paralysis, and it's taken over the old hag. You hear it now, where people say, well, people don't see fairies anymore, that's why we see aliens. And I'm like, you clearly don't know enough.
Because
there's thousands of people around the world who are still seeing the little people.
Yeah, absolutely. We went to the Isle of Man the other year, and there's a bus that we got, and it literally, the bus stops on this bridge, and everyone on the bus has to, and it's not like it's a tour bus, it's a bus, it's like a general get from A to B sort of bus, and it stops on a bridge, and we all have to, the driver literally says, there's like an automated voice that says, say good morning to the fairies, everyone. And everyone has to go, good morning, fairies. And me and Becca were like, what the fuck is this? But it was a genuine, like, it's just a normal bus. It wasn't like the fairy talk.
Yeah.
You know, just that was the level of belief. Like, don't cross and be nice, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's, I mean, obviously my brother got married in Norway. So I've been to Norway quite a bit, Kev. Their acceptance of trolls would be laughed at here. And yet you can't go past more than four shops without seeing a troll inside or outside. And they have all these animatronic ones, like one's asleep in the sweetie aisle and stuff because they've had too many sweets and things, and they have special ones outside. But they think, oh, well, they're just playing up to the tourists. But when you start speak to your normal Norwegians, a lot of people still have a real belief in that.
Yeah, and by troll, they mean like 40-foot high.
Well, they believe they're all sizes.
Right. Okay.
Not the modern cinematic versions, as good as those films are.
And I'm asking this as literally an uneducated person within the subject of trolls. Are they the equivalent of you know where our fae folk, if you like, were originally human sized?
Mm.
Or have been perceived as human size, and then they grew little and whatever else, and they've been perceived as loads of different sizes. Mm. Is it the equivalent of trolls?
But they've got different sizes, so as far as they're different, just different types.
Okay.
They haven't shrunk through, because sometimes people would say that the concept of why fairies have shrunk is the fact that less people believe in them.
Okay, I've
heard. But then again, the majority of reports in the modern era, they are all of a certain size, but then certain people think, oh, well, they're all like Tinkerbell, when they're clearly not. If you've read anything about the lore of the Fae, they're clearly not to be trifled with. But then even in the UK, and I've said this before, Kev, you look at what they have in Scotland and compare even on the Isle of Man, Wales, Cornwall, England, Ireland, we've all got the same similar kind of thing, but they're all very different creatures.
Yeah, it's a very good point. It's a very good point. I do. I mean, to be honest, the Fae is one, because we spoke about it earlier, but, like, you know, I know Brennan's got a fear of the Fae and not upsetting them. But again, it plays into the wonderfulness of our brains. You know, it's that whole, if you believe you can or believe you can't, you're right. you know, it's that ties into it in a way, I think, in terms of sometimes with belief in the paranormal. We don't know the power of our brains. And I was going to mention it earlier before when you were saying about, you know, if you see a house, some people will see an abandoned house and you'll go back and it's not there.
Mm.
I don't think maybe it's a time slip, like you're saying, but maybe it's also not like a ghost house or whatever. Maybe it's your brain at that particular moment has given off some sort of discharge or impulse, or, you know, the same sort of thing that triggers an epileptic fit. For example, it's given you the ability of some sort of sight that, you know, to, I don't know. And the thing is, we don't know.
Yeah.
And that's the marvelous. I find it fascinating. I'm really, really getting into to reactions of things now, you know, just people's general reactions and studying human beings. Human beings are turning out now for me to be a bit more interesting and a bit less believable than the paranormal.
Mm.
You know, when you see how they react to certain things in certain ways and how predictable people are and stuff. There's a lot of really great philosophy books out there which have bent me head of late. I've had to stop reading some because I end up talking to people and thinking, I know what you're going to say. You feel like I'm going mad. But,
yeah. Well, I know what you mean. I mean, I've always been darkly fascinated and quite afraid sometimes when I read about certain cult cases.
Yes.
And I just sometimes think, how on earth do they push themselves? The Heaven's Gate is a prime example.
Wow. Yeah.
Primarily because that happened smack bang in the middle of the 90s when I was embracing all kinds of Fortiana.
Yeah.
And so for a case as weird as that to happen when everybody was talking about UFOs and the X-Files and we've got chupacabras running around everywhere,
yeah,
and good quality documentaries and shows on TV investigating certain cases and looking at personal experiences, it's surprising just how regular these things happen. And obviously, as I've got older, I've looked at other cases like Jonestown and things, and you just think, at what point do you go past the point of no return in those kinds of situations? Because Heaven's Gate especially is crazy. And I remember seeing a documentary last year where they were visiting one of those museums of the macabre that they have.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And he'd got one of the beds.
Jesus, what were possession? Literally, what were possession?
And it was all done out, like with a mannequin on the bed, wearing the trainers under those blue blankets that they all wore.
Yeah.
And I just thought, I mean, Marshall Applewhite gave me the chills in the 90s. Every time I see his face these days, it just sends a shiver up and down my spine.
Yeah.
Because you just... But it's just that further extension of that whole contactee movement that we had in the 50s, that they were that. That's what their plan was. They were all going to be taken away by a UFO that was hanging around in the back of Halley's Comet.
Yeah. Well, what was the place in France where it was a similar thing? Renowned for it. Oh, I can't think of them. But it was a small little town, and I think it was very recently as well, like where it was renowned that, like, you know, we're all going there because, you know, that's where we're all going to be salvaged, where the rapture's going to take place.
There is a place in France that they've built a UFO landing place, haven't they? Because they think that they're...
Oh, that might be it, yeah.
There's one of those strange... There's a few of those around the place. There's one in Scotland, isn't there? And there's several in the US, obviously.
you know what? It's funny, like, talking about, like, the... You know, like the like what we're talking about there, brainwashing basically, you know, and things like that. It fascinates me that the manipulation we can do to people's brains, and, like, you know, for example, JFK, who was the other Kennedy who was shot?
Bobby.
And the guy who was claimed he was a Manchurian candidate.
Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I can't remember the guy's name who shot him.
Sirhan.
The animal you do, obviously. Paula Pedia over there. He's always claimed, you know, he's got no recollection. The last thing he recalls seeing is, was it a woman in a polka dot dress or something? Derren Brown replicated the entire thing. Derren Brown proved it could happen. He's got an episode out where he manipulated a guy over a series of weeks so that when he sees a woman in a polka dot dress, he would be handed a briefcase, open it, pull out a gun and shoot Stephen Fry on stage, put the gun back in the case, give it back to the lady, and then he'd wake up. And he wakes up with no recollection of what's happened. He just sees the body on the floor.
Is that on Trick or Treat?
Yeah. But it's been proved. This is what but I can't, you know, I can't get my head around. It's been proven that it can take place.
Yeah.
So why is he still in jail? Why is no one looking further into these things?
Well, there's a lot of strange things about that particular situation, isn't there? But I mean, it is remarkable because obviously there's a very similar story about Mark Chapman, isn't there?
Yeah.
The Catcher in the Rye was his trigger.
There's a trigger, yeah, within Catcher in the Rye. And there's a new thing come out apparently about two different types of bullets being found in Lennon's body, which I don't know too much about, if I'm being perfectly honest. But the Catcher in the Rye is a common thing, isn't it? I think it was used in something else as well, allegedly.
Yeah.
As a trigger word.
Yeah.
Or there's something within it which can set people off.
I mean, it's those kind of things that open people up to conspiracies, because there have been enough illicit operations gone on by espionage agencies in all countries, all across the world, Kev, that you just think it's not hard to understand sometimes why people see grey when they've got black and white, because, you know, we know things, you know, like that Bulgarian diplomat that was poisoned by the Russians in London. He was stabbed with a mercury-laced umbrella.
Umbrella, yeah. Litvinenko, was it? And but this is the thing, and like all MK Ultra, they're still paying out literally compensation for people who were part of the experiments.
Yeah.
And are we meant to assume this is no longer taking place? They've all just decided to not do it anymore?
Yeah, well, it's like UFOs, Kev. They've not been investigating them for 50 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Area 51 didn't exist.
No.
Until they decided to tell us it did. It's like, we knew. Yeah.
And then we got Area 52.
Well, yeah, exactly. But this is the thing. It's like, I can't remember who said it. I mean, it was so, and it won't be this quote verbatim by any means, but it was something along the lines of, give them alcohol, give them football, and they won't worry about anything else. Do you know what I mean? Keep the masses entertained. And,
opium for the masses.
Exactly, yeah.
As Orwell would say. Well, that's what Orwell used to say about religion, wasn't it?
Oh, really? Yeah. But that's a good quote.
But it is. It's remarkable what people will do and the belief systems that can be toyed with and changed. And I suppose it is easy to, if you, as you mentioned there, Derren Brown, he knows the right way to push people's buttons.
Yeah.
Psychologically, and as he says, one of his brilliant things is the fact, I always love it when he does his live stage shows, and then he gets to the end, does the big reveal, and then he goes back and tells you exactly what he's done and why he's done it. Did you see the one he did a couple of years ago where it was all to do with Red 5?
Oh, I think so, yeah.
And I think it was on an Easter 2 or 3 years ago. It's one of them now. I know, not that I know what to look for, but there's certain things that happen and you just think,
Yeah.
Because that was that, you had to push down on the box and all the boxes had nails in apart from one.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah.
But clever.
I remember reading one thing that Derren Brown said and stuck with me since I read it, and I thought, what a clever analogy or breakdown to what he does. And what he basically said was this, and it really stuck with me, and I thought, bloody genius. He says, if I'm sat in a living room, he said, all he does is an escalated version of this situation. He says, if he sat in a living room and he wants his partner to pass him the remote control, he says, that's his outcome. Derren Brown's outcome is he wants his partner to give him the remote control. He says, now if he says, like, Steve, pass me the remote control, Steve will say, get it yourself. If Derren says, where's the remote control? Steve's been given a challenge. Steve spots the remote control. He knows he can gain some serotonin, some dopamine. He can win something. And I found it. Here you go. There it is. Oh, thanks, mate. The ultimate result was Derren wanted him to pass him the remote control.
Yeah.
But there's two ways of going about it.
Yeah.
You know, one doesn't get him it and one does. And he says all he does is the escalated version of that. And I just found that fascinating, you know, how that's a very subtle manipulation, but that's how easy it is.
Yeah. As the old adage goes, Kev, it's not what you say, it's how you say it.
Very true. Yeah, very true. In fact, you know what? It's hysterical. And this is might be a good way to sort of end it, because it can kind of get back to me being a bit of a farce. When I was doing these cold monitorings on people, I had to do a report on someone, and it was only about 19, maybe 20. And I thought he had a good grasp of the English language. Someone was amazing as a customer service rep.
Yeah.
So I wrote them a glowing report, and within that report said, they are a shining star. In fact, I'd go as far as to say they are completely detrimental to the success of the company. And my manager pulled me to one side and went, do you understand what the word detrimental means? And I was like, yeah, well, doesn't it mean like without them we wouldn't succeed? And he went, oh no, oh no. It's amazing.
Oh, we've all been there, mate.
Yeah.
We've all been the joys of customer service.
Call monitorings, honestly. There's nothing worse than sitting down to someone and saying, I've got to tell you why you're bad at something that I've not asked about. It's just like, for God's sake.
Oh, it reminds, I remember, yeah, because I've done that as well, obviously working in the financial sector on and off for nearly 20 years.
Yeah.
I remember doing it with a lovely guy, really nice, and I just sat down and said, right, I've got your call feedback, and he just burst into tears. You know, and I'd like to think I'm a very, very positive kind of professional person when I'm in my day job. You know, very supportive, very sort of proactive. I'm not one of those, oh, this is shit, whatever.
Yeah.
Don't deal with that. I look at, you know, let's deal with this in a positive. I'd rather deal with the situation than thrash about and point fingers and whatever.
Yeah, I agree.
And I just couldn't understand it, Kev. I thought, what? I've literally just sat down and said, I'm going to give you your feedback. And he just burst into tears. And I took him out of the centre, because obviously there's loads of people around. And
yeah.
You know what they're like in that kind of environment.
Yes,
what's exactly. He said? He's got sack. And he just said, oh, I'm just not used to this. And I'm not used to getting feedback. And I just get myself really anxious. And I said, God, you don't need to be like that. And he said, I know, but it just happened. And I said, well, it does sometimes. People work themselves up into a frenzy over the most trivial of things.
Yeah. I'm telling you, the brain, we've not touched the surface of the brain. And no. That's the fascinating thing. And I'm saying that like I'm going to do something about it. I'm a hot, but, you know, but I hope somebody does. I hope somebody finds out, you know, more about what we yet don't know.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's plenty.
Absolutely. Well, there's loads of weird things, I think, as a final wrap-up of that, Kev. When people get struck by lightning and all of a sudden they develop new talents. And you think, well, what? How's that happened? Or those people that suffer amnesia and wake up and they speak in a foreign language.
That's the one that gets me. That just, you know,
blows you away.
It does. I mean, and I can appreciate, like, maybe they picked enough up and something's happened. But the thing is, even if, because I've heard people say, yeah, well, maybe they've just been exposed to that language on TV in the past. And what's happened is it's not that whatever's happened, the lightning shock or whatever, has knocked it all into space, so it's made them know a bit more of the language. That's magnificent. That's magic.
Yeah.
If that's took place, that's magic.
Yeah.
Don't just say, well, what's probably happened is they've learned French overnight, because that's bloody magic. You know what I mean? Don't just try and brush that under the carpet. What probably happened is.
Yeah, he's probably changed his diet. That's what's caused it.
Yeah.
Oh, well, Kev, it's been fabulous just to chew the fat and throw some ideas around, my friend.
No, it certainly has. And again, Paul, I sincerely mean this. I'm not just blowing smoke. And I've said it many a time before, and I say it to anyone who will pay attention, is your knowledge is... There are very few people in this world, I'll be genuinely serious. There's a paranormal podcaster who's been doing it for close to 8 years now, and who's got an interest in the paranormal since it's been five or whatever. Mm. But a few people in the world who I'll listen to the opinion of and not question or not think, yeah, but, and you're one of them. So it's a privilege to be on your show, mate. I really appreciate it.
No, it's a privilege to have you join me at last, Kevin. It's been a long time coming and long overdue, and I hope it's not the last time we speak in a professional capacity. And so, my friend, where can everybody follow your work, find your shows, and keep up to date with what's coming down the pipeline for you, my friend?
Just search for We Need to Talk About Ghosts. I'm sure some people might be aware of her anyway and don't like it. That's fine. And search for The Dark Paranormal, which is the other show. Some people might not like that, and that's fine. But on the other hand, other people might. So there you go. You can't please all the people all the time. Oh, and the same would go. I know you meant to then do social shout outs. Search for the same on whenever you do your social things. You'll find them as well.
I'll put links to everything in the show notes, as always. I know. Have you any plans to collect any of the stories that you've been sent or whatever as a book or a collection at any point, Kevin?
In terms of The Dark Paranormal, but only with a few select ones. Like, we had one standout one from the last season, which we received a letter, not a letter, because it's not 1924, we received an email from a lay-sized priest. And he used a lot of words which I didn't understand and I had to Google.
Right.
And he basically was a very, like, as a very quick, brief explanation. The weird thing is about this story is nothing truly paranormal happens in it. Nothing like moves or flies or anything like this. But it's one of the stories that we've got the most feedback on. Basically, he was chosen by his diocese to attend an exorcism course.
Mm.
And he went to it, he came back. And he was convinced that this particular woman in his parish needed an exorcism, basically. And he went to see his bishop or similar, and they said, when he described what was going on, they said, no, they just need confession. Mm. And he tried to explain that there was no possible way he could get this woman to confession. And due to the fallout of all this and how it all took place and what went on, he asked to leave the church. And was granted it. But it turns out, and I didn't know this, that if you ask to leave the church and you're granted it, if you then want to become a priest again, it's like an admin task. It's not like you have to go through the whole ritual again.
Mm.
But it's kind of like if you're a priest, you're a priest for life. You can just, you know, you just need to ask kindly to come back in, and they're just like, it's like reactivating your Facebook account.
Yes.
It would appear. So I learned so much about, like, throughout that case, but as I say, nothing, you know, there was no flying through the air. There was a few scary, arguably mental health issues that this person had. We don't know, as in the woman he was referring to. But the entire story and narrative around it was just fascinating. And it's so some of the stories like that, which I think they're important stories for paranormal people or people who are into the paranormal to know about. I might get some of them down in a book, which aren't to do with, like, things smashing against walls. You know, things which just make you think, like, which it could be one thing. It could be something completely rational.
Mm.
It could also be the work of the devil. You know, stuff that is, it can happen on the fence.
Mm-hmm. Ah, intriguing, intriguing. Well, I look forward to it because the new season of Dark Paranormal has just landed as well, hasn't it, my friend?
It will have, and this is out, mate, yeah. It's, yes, we've got a great first story, and I'm being really, as per usual, behind on everything that I'm doing. So currently, I've got about 30 stories that have been sent in, and I'm like, yes for that one, yes for that one, yes for that one. Last count, there was 15 episodes for the next season, but I only have a max of 10. So I'm whittling them down as we're going. Mm. And it's taking longer than I thought, let me put it that way.
Brilliant. Well, listen, it's been a real pleasure as always, my friend. Don't be a stranger. Continued success for everything you do. It's a joy to hear your new episodes whenever they land. And I just wish you all the very best for your future endeavours, Kevin. Hopefully we'll speak again, my friend.
Hopefully so, my mate, yeah. And and as always, I'll continue to be a constant listener to your show and gain my education via you. Because that's how I literally do it.
That's very kind of you. Thank you. You take care, my friend.
You too, Paul.